supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Who wants to be an astrophysicist? Now, before you submit an application, let's consider the job requirements with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, I suspect you hear from lots of kids considering a career in the field of astronomy, but if it's as focused as astrophysics, how do you stoke the enthusiasm and still convey the required rigor to pursue it?
I do get this question often from students, from high school students, or parents of high school students who have an interest in astronomy and astrophysics as a career path. And while it may look very exciting, the idea of being at the observatory at night with your eye at the eyepiece making fabulous discoveries, the reality is that that's not the way things actually go these days. It's much, much more rigorously tied to research, mathematics, computer modeling that require an interested party to really be deeply interested in those aspects of astronomical research rather than the more romantic idea.
Does that almost immediately disqualify most who otherwise think they want to go into the field?
Well, that's a really interesting question. What we have to do is we have to make sure we can give those folks who are interested in this a much better look at what the career is so that they can make the choice for themselves. So tomorrow evening, June 19th at 7:30 p.m. at University of Pennsylvania's David Rittenhouse Laboratories, I'm doing a program in collaboration with University of Pennsylvania and the Simons Observatory. I'm moderating a panel discussion for aspiring astrophysicists about what it takes to become an astrophysicist and what the life of an astrophysicist is like. I have three astronomers who are in town for a meeting about their particular astronomical research project, along with a group of others who are going to help us answer this question. And so I'm reaching out as far as I can across the Delaware Valley to ask high school students and their parents, this is the program for you to bring your student to if that student is expressing an interest in astrophysics, because they'll have a chance to ask these astronomers questions right up front about what it's like to be in this career field.
Of course, astrophysics is a subset of the broader field of astronomy, and there are many career paths to consider.
So it could be instrumentation, or it could be telescope engineering, or it could be electronics, or computer software, or any of those associated fields that really could allow one to be just as close to this kind of work as possible.
Of course, it touches a very old urge of man based on long before language and writing to look aloft and try to make sense of what's there to be seen. Let's merely go back some 3 centuries and pay homage to the Royal Greenwich Observatory.
Yes, coming up on this Friday, it's the 343rd anniversary of the Royal Greenwich Observatory's founding. It's just up the Thames River from London. This is the origination point for the Earth's geographic grid system component known as longitude. And from that point, we begin to count up the degrees of longitude around the rest of the planet, heading west and heading east. So here in Philadelphia, we're at 75 degrees west longitude.
So that ground zero longitude is truly arbitrary. It's a man-made line.
Longitude, of course, could have begun anywhere on the planet. You might even wonder, why did we put it there rather than putting it closer to something like the International Date Line that's way out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? But there's a reason why. That's where the center of shipboard navigation in the world was at that time. So that's why it began there. There's no reason why it couldn't have begun anywhere else. And fortunately, everyone around the world has agreed to that convention that this is how the geographic setup of our planet would be set up.
So that was some 343 years ago on Friday. Sticking with anniversaries, there's another spaceship ride anniversary of note, and that took place in 1983.
Yes, that's true. Today, in 1983, Sally Ride became the first American woman to fly in space. And from that point on, women have been a significant portion of space crews going forward. Admittedly, it was a slow start to get more women into the program and up to speed as being regularly part of space shuttle crews. But today, the person that has the greatest number of hours on board International Space Station is a woman, Peggy Whitson.
That it took until 1983 to reach this milestone, was that due in part to a notion that perhaps women weren't up to the rigor of space travel?
Actually, it's the result of an American military reluctance to place women in space. When the American space program began, there were a series of women who tested through the program and did everything the men did to qualify to become the first astronauts. But no one on the women's team was selected to become astronauts at that time. So women had been through all of the same rigors, flight training, flight education, capability of flying jet aircraft, everything the men had gone through, but still weren't selected until 1983. In 1963, the Russian space agency selected Valentina Tereshkova to become the first woman in space, but that's 1963, just 2 years after their first manned flight into space. So you could say that the Soviet Union was well ahead of us in that particular aspect. And today, we see that there are fewer Russian women in the space program, yet Americans now have many, many more women involved in the space program flying regularly.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.